So, speaking of synergy, this is the time in the show when we invite all of our intrepid producers into the studio. We fire up the Tandy 1000 TX to get a read on all the news you've been clicking and Googling out
We have
there.
one of those?
We do. It's in the back room. It's at my desk. They are the most read stories on the internets, and they are the most. Ian, headphones on.
All right, I'm here.
What you got to say?
This is the most viewed from Action News in Philly. One of my favorite local news stations. Sometime I'm going to do a best song about their theme song.
Right.
It's amazing. It has words. Okay, so in Philly, you know, there are two cheesesteak places. I mean, there are 150 cheesesteak places, but there are two that sort of signify the Philly cheesesteak.
Geno's, right?
Yes, Geno's. Anybody know the other one?
Pat's. Been there too.
Okay.
Wow.
And they're different cheesesteaks. Geno's has a sort of thinner, finer cut. Pat's is a little thicker. Geno's sort of looks like Times Square. Pat's looks like an alley where you might be assaulted. I'm a Pat's man myself. And for the last couple years, there's been some kind of a controversy with Geno's.
Yeah, I interviewed the Geno's dude.
Joey Vinto.
Yeah.
So
how could I forget?
They put up a sign in their window that said, "This is America. When ordering, speak English." It had a flag and an eagle. This became a big deal.
Yes, I remember.
People were very upset about it. And Philadelphia sort of launched an investigation, seeing if this sign actually violated their fair practices ordinance, if it was discriminating against customers. And about a month ago, they determined that, no, it's actually not discriminatory for some reason. And but now Joey Vinto, he's still upset. He's saying, you know what, the Fair Practices Ordinance, it's not implemented in a fair way. It's arbitrary. Nobody knows sort of what's fair and what's unfair. So he's kind of threatening to sue the city to get the practice changed. He wants an apology from Mayor Nutter. He's really mad at a councilman who sort of voiced complaints with Geno's that, you know, if people think of this is like a Philly institution, if we're telling people that, you know, they have to speak English or they can't come to Philly, we're going to lose tourists. So we'll kind of follow what happens. I just want to say one more thing about this, which is when you go to Pat's or Geno's, you don't say, I would like a cheesesteak with American cheese and onions. You say, American wit, which means American cheese with onions. That's not English.
Yeah. That isn't English. That's cheesesteakies.
Cheesesteak language.
Matt Martinez has returned
back
to the New York studios from the mothership down in D.C.
Yes, and once again, Google Trends proves that Americans sit in front of their computers while watching TV, or vice versa. Number one on Google Trends overnight was Amber Hagerman of Amber Alert. And it turns out that last night, Lifetime aired a 2006 TV movie that tells the story of Amber, whose abduction and murder led to the creation of the first Amber Alert system. So that was number one overnight. I saw that name this morning. I was like, why is her name popping up of all times?
Good. Yeah. It's Googling to educate yourself.
Exactly.
That's a good reason to Google.
So people got the education last night. Also, number three on Google Trends overnight was the search for lyrics for the song Angels by Robbie Williams, because David Archuleta sang it last night on American Idol. You know, I just don't like this kid. I don't like this kid. I really don't want him to win.
You know what I want to learn more about? I want to talk to the band leader for American Idol.
The band is unbelievable.
They play everything.
The choir is unbelievable on American Idol.
I love that American Idol has like a death grip on Google Trends.
It really, really does.
If they really want to test these people, they ought to really put them up there with like a really lame backup band, like most people start, like most real singers start out with.
Well, anyway, everybody loved David Archuleta last night, except me, sitting alone in my apartment.
Okay, I'm going to tell you about crabby, grumpy waiters in Germany and how one restaurateur is trying to get out of hiring them altogether. If you've been to a restaurant in Germany, the waiters, I don't want to fall prey to stereotyping, but but let's anyway. The waiters in Germany are not so outgoing, not super friendly. They're not unnice. They just don't really go out of their way to chat you up or anything. So one German restaurant has decided they're just going to get rid of the waiters. It costs too much to pay them anyway, and he's fully automated his restaurant. It's a robot restaurant. He's created this big machine that looks like a roller coaster with long metal tracks that crisscross the dining area. And what you do, you sit down and you get on a computer screen at your table and you order through the computer. And then, you know, a few minutes later, your food is kind of conveyed to you on these tracks and delivered to you at your table. And so you never have to come in contact with any grumpy Germans.
And Mark Garrison in the studio with your most emailed from Yahoo?
Yes, Yahoo, which is available for purchase for about $45 billion. We'll talk about that a little bit later in the show. But Dan Pashman saw this about 2 hours north. If we were to drive from the Bryant Park studios, we would find a magic, mysterious stream that's just kind of formed in, I don't know where, it's about the size of a football field, but people are coming there to drink it. Thought it was something needed. Turns out it's just a busted drinking water pipe. And the EPA says, you know, pretty much everything is like this. It's going to take $277 billion. That's almost six Yahoos to repair our drinking water system.
That's a lot.
So
a lot of Yahoos.
Appreciate your tap when you turn it on.
Yeah.
Dan, you're going to wrap it up.
That's
with...
That's right. Most email here from NPR.org. And one of these stories, most emailed at NPR.org right now, is part of the NPR Climate Connection series with National Geographic. It's about climate change through pop music. Now, this story involves... pop music, the Ukraine, and climate change, which are not three things I expected to find in the same story.
Together,
I feel
yeah.
like Lisa Simpson when she saw that sign that said Yahoo Sirius Festival, and she said, I know what those words mean, but I don't understand that sign. Well, NPR's Dan Charles did a report on a woman in Ukraine who's making environmentally conscious music. She's a former member of parliament and the country's biggest pop star. Here's NPR's Dan Charles.
I'm Rusana. I'm a singer from Ukraine. Now I present Ukraine in the world with my new project, Wild Energy.
Like a Brazilian soccer star, Ruslana gets by with just one name, and everybody in Ukraine knows it. In her music, you can hear echoes of Ukrainian folk songs, but nobody's going to call Ruslana a folk singer. Her live shows are spectacles with fire, smoke, dancers, and costumes. In the middle of it all, there's Ruslana tossing her hair, stamping her feet, and usually not wearing very much, a small bundle of unbridled energy. That image is why she originally decided to call her new stage show Wild Energy. Yuri Melnik, her international publicity manager, says the words just seem to fit her style.
But it later transcended into something much bigger. The energy of the wind, the energy of the sun, the energy of water.
Renewable energy, energy independence.
Ruslana says she wants to get people thinking about the environmental cost of fossil fuels and the dangers of global climate change, not by lecturing, but with dazzle and a driving beat.
It's very important to show this issue very visually. It has to be presented very well, so teenagers don't just hear it, they really understand that.
So Ruslana doesn't sing about carbon footprints and gas prices. She sings about the wild energy of love. It triumphs over a synthetic world dependent on synthetic energy. In the video version, it's a pale, metallic-looking woman who gets her strength from a giant machine. You may look nice, Ruslana sings, but that synthetic mask isn't really you. Ukraine is not a rich country, but it burns coal and gas as if it were. Ukraine consumes almost as much energy per person as Italy, even though the average Italian is four times richer. Most of Ukraine's energy, especially natural gas, comes from Russia, and every so often, Russia threatens to cut Ukraine off. In fact, that's a big reason why Ruslana got interested in this issue. She's a Ukrainian nationalist. She joined street protests that brought down a government in 2004 and took a seat briefly in Ukraine's parliament. She's pushing for greater independence from Russia, including energy independence.
Ukrainians should know that they are not as dependent on natural gas as they think they are.
But it's really not easy getting young Ukrainians interested in clean, green, homegrown energy.
For young people, they don't care about this, I think.
Roman Lebed is a 21-year-old journalist in Kyiv. His friend Ina Zhelezna is a student. She's 19.
They think about their everyday problems.
Something which is closer for me, like, I don't know, I have to finish my university, so why should I think about some global warming?
All of us know about this problem, but only few are really concerned about it and really think that we should do something.
Even Irina Stavchuk, who works specifically on climate change for one of Ukraine's environmental groups, says she can't really get her generation interested.
They just don't want to listen anything about it. One thing could be it's not interesting. Another thing could be they don't want to be bothered with anything.
They're too busy hanging on as their country continues its wild ride from Soviet Socialist Republic into capitalism. They've seen dramatic changes, and underneath a layer of Slavic melancholy, there's a touch of amazement. Irina Kosovar is an economist with a consulting company.
Yes, it's this life is more competitive, yes, but you have a lot of opportunities, really. A lot of opportunities.
In the capital city of Kyiv, wealth seems almost within reach now. It's there on television, billboards, and on the streets, clogged with shiny new cars. In fact, if there's one thing that's the focus of life in the new capitalist Ukraine today, it's...
Money.
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 Get some money.
Young people in Ukraine spend a lot of time thinking about how to get money.
Yes. Yes, it's question number one.
Ruslana, though, is trying to persuade young Ukrainians that coal and gas are just as vital as cash.
Energy is like currency, like money. This is how I see it in my project. It's the most valuable currency, and until we realize it, we are going to waste it.
Yet, even Ruslana, for all her energy and celebrity, sounds at times a little unsure that her cause will catch on. To be honest, she says, I'm a little bit afraid of starting a PR campaign about climate change or Ukraine's appetite for fossil fuels. She says she needs more allies and sponsors. She doesn't want to be a lonely voice.
We have a video of Ruslana on our site. You can see that and get links to all the stories you heard in today's Most by going to our website, npr.org/Bryant Park.
Well, here's a quote for you. Almost everything about Iraq is hard. Those were the words of Ambassador Ryan Crocker, who was questioned on Capitol Hill Tuesday, along with the top American commander in Iraq, General David Petraeus. There were familiar themes sound at these hearings before the Senate Armed Services and Foreign Relations Committees. We heard about troop reductions, sectarian violence, and Iraqi readiness. However, there was some more discussion about Iran and less about benchmarks than in previous sit-downs between our legislative, military, and diplomatic leaders. In studio with us right now is Stephen Cook, a Council on Foreign Relations Fellows and an advisor to the Iraq Study Group led by James Baker and Lee Hamilton. Thanks for coming into the studio.
My pleasure.
Appreciate it. You, as someone who watched and listened with a far more educated ear than most of us.
Until my eyes glazed.
It was a little bit of that, I have to admit. Even when I was cooking dinner, I was like, okay, Joe Biden. What struck you the most about Petraeus and Crocker, what they had to say yesterday?
Well, I thought there were two things that were really striking. First was the way they hammered away at Iran. Really laying the blame with the Iranians for the events in Basra of the last couple of weeks, forgetting two things. One, it was the Iranians that helped get the ceasefire and the Iranians who are holding back the Mahdi army now, although Muqtada al-Sadr yesterday was making noises about bringing people out into the streets again, and the Iranians basically told them to cool it. That's not to suggest that the Iranians have been constructive in Iraq, but nevertheless, there was sort of a one-sided, shaded-to-one-side narrative about the Iranian role. I think the second interesting part about this was that there was this tension between what they were saying about, well, this is fragile and reversible. But then in all of the questioning that they got, and in the afternoon in particular from the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, they kept saying, well actually, everything's going pretty well. And they really were, you know, deflecting that type of criticism, especially when Chuck Hagel said to Crocker, well, what's this about the regional situation? Nobody here really shares our interests. None of the neighbors really share the interests. And when they were hammering Crocker on the political development, there's really not much there. Yes, 4 of 6 laws have been passed, but there are 14 benchmarks. There's been very, very little progress.
Yeah, you didn't hear the B word, benchmark.
No, not at all.
Very much compared to what we heard in September.
Well, of course, because when so few of them have actually been met, and those that have been met, if you read the fine print, it shows that we really haven't gotten very far since September.
I want to go back to Iran because I, too, was struck by how often Iran came up and stoking violence, their contribution to that in Iraq, as opposed to what you just talked about. Is it just a reality that Crocker and Petraeus had to acknowledge, or is there something else that we should read into all the Iranian references?
Well, I think it's clear the Iranians are bad actors, but we also have to recognize the fact that Iran is a neighbor of Iraq, and it's only natural that they are going to seek to extend their influence in this country that had been the counterweight to them in this very important region. So they're going to play every single side. So it's not just that the Iranians are supporting Shia militias, but they're also supporting the government that we created in Iraq. Nouri al-Maliki, Abdulaziz Hakim, all of these guys have strong ties to the Iranians. And
we knew that going in, setting up that government.
It's debatable how much we knew going in. But, of course, we know that now. And we knew that when we were setting up this Shia-based government, that they were clearly going to have ties to the Iranians. They have better ties with the Iranians than we do, which may be a good thing for post-withdrawal Iraq. But then again, it may not be such a good thing.
Iraqi readiness was another issue. How did Petraeus explain the situation we saw in Basra last week, where the Iraqi forces basically failed to take on the militias?
Well, this was a very, very interesting part of the testimony. He basically dismissed the fact that 1,000 guys, including 2 senior officers, refused to fight.
See ya.
Yeah, basically they're like, we're not fighting. We won't have anything to do with it. It's not our fight. And he emphasized the fact that, well, there were technical reasons. They mobilized and deployed very quickly and threw themselves into the fight too quickly. And it was a tough battle. And, well, these kinds of things happen. He really glossed over that. And I think it's telling about the readiness of the Iraq security forces that, A, 1,000 guys did desert. B, they had to call in close air support and American forces to support them against these militias in Basra. Clearly, with all of the billions of dollars have spent on training 400,000+ Iraqi security forces, they're not ready to do the job.
Should we be focusing, though, on 1,000 who left when we've trained that many, though?
Well, the question is, how many more are there like those 1,000 out there? Remember, they were fully trained up and ready when we threw them into the Battle of Fallujah in 2004, and they basically melted away. That's not to suggest that, you know, some elements of the Iraqi security forces are ready, but clearly they need our support, they need our coordination, they need our logistic ability and our firepower from the air.
We're talking to Stephen Cook, a counsel and foreign relations fellow and advisor to the Iraq study group that was led by James Baker and Lee Hamilton. Can you stick around a little bit more? Because I do want to talk about troop withdrawal. I know we talk about it a lot, but there are some really interesting details that came out yesterday.
Be happy to.
All right. Stay with us here at the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. More about the testimony of Ryan Crocker and David Petraeus on Capitol Hill yesterday.